My name is Jeff Lerner, and I interview elite performers from a wide range of disciplines, entrepreneurs, athletes, celebrities, scientists, artists, and more. This is Unlock Your Potential.
Welcome to another episode of Unlock Your Potential. Jeff Lerner, your host. Always so glad to be back with you, getting to have amazing conversations with amazing human beings and help you unlock your full potential in every area of life. Today, we are joined by Kevin Kelly, who I was told, somebody said, somebody actually, our booker said, you're interviewing Kevin tomorrow. So this, Kevin is the man, and Kevin, I don't know if you're prone to egomania, but if so, you might want to plug your ears. He said, the most interesting people in the world think that Kevin is the most interesting person in the world. So you'll be very glad to have him on the show. Anyway, I'll give you a more proper biographical introduction. He is the senior maverick at Wired Magazine, which is probably a self-deprecating way of saying, like, he's kind of the main dude. He co-founded Wired in 1993, served as its executive editor for the first 7 years, just published a new book called Excellent Advice for Living, a book of 450 modern proverbs for good living. I'm excited to hear more about that. He is the co-chair of the Long Now Foundation, a membership organization that champions long-term thinking. So much want to talk about long-term thinking. Seems to be in, no pun intended, short supply these days. And acting as a good ancestor to future generations. Honestly, you got to go to Kevin's blog. Like, I just got lost down the rabbit hole yesterday that is Kevin's blog and all of its offshoot ancillary sites. He's the founder of the Cool Tools website, which has been reviewing tools daily for 20 years. From 1984 to 1990, he was the publisher and editor of the Whole Earth Review, a subscriber-supported journal of unorthodox conceptual news. He co-founded the ongoing Hackers Conference. He was involved with the launch of The Well, a pioneering online service, in 1985. You don't often see the words online and 1985 in the same sentence. So he's been around. It's probably fair to say he's older than the internet. Because I think he might have helped invent the damn thing.
Yeah.
Although that was Al Gore, I think so.
Right.
Anyway, on and on. Like, his bio is like this interesting list of interesting things. But honestly, Kevin, I'm just going to jump to the part where I say I'm really glad to have you on the show, man.
It's such a delight to be here. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Thanks for having me.
No, of course. And actually, the one thing that is in the rest of your scripted bio that I didn't mention that I actually think is really cool, so I'm going to mention it just because I'd love to circle back to it in the conversation, is the Vanishing Asia book that you published, which is a 50-year project to photograph the disappearing cultures of Asia. I was just caught up in rapture with some of those images yesterday when I was perusing your world. And I also love this statement. He is best known for his radical optimism about the future. I think that's something we all need you to vamp on a little bit for us these days. So with such a career and such a list of interests and accomplishments, if you were interviewing Kevin Kelly, what do you think would be the most interesting place to start?
If I was interviewing Kevin Kelly, I would assume that he's been asked about the genesis of the book on every podcast, so I would not start there.
Fair enough.
I would start at the end. I would say, so what are you doing next?
Well, I was going to say, you talk about futurism a lot. You're like a futurist. So by the end, I don't even know if you mean the present or like the end, right?
Right. And who knows? It can go either way.
Right.
That makes a good question.
Yeah. So maybe that's the starting point then, is what do you mean by the end?
Well, so I don't believe that there's an end point, an omega point. I don't believe that there's an end and a destination even for our lives. I believe that we're, the little bit of advice in the book is that basically, like, as long as you're alive, there's lessons to learn. And once you learn one lesson, as long as you're alive, there'll be another lesson to learn. And I talk about trying to aim to be, you know, in the spot where we can kind of truly be ourselves. That's not a destination. You don't end there. You're
to truly be ourself.
Right.
What you said? Okay.
Right. To truly be ourselves. To be our authentic self, to do the things that only we can do, to do the things that we're here to do, that is not a destination. That's a direction. You can't ever really arrive there. Nobody that I know has arrived there. The most remarkable, accomplished people that I am around are still working, still figuring out, still asking the question of, what do I do next? What do I do when I grow up? They may be 85, but they're still asking that question. And having $1 billion, by the way, does not answer that question. Okay? Being famous does not answer that question. And so so there is no real end. There is no destination in life. I think there is just directions. And what you want to be is on this trajectory, on the path that's headed in that direction of becoming more yourself. And you don't actually ever arrive as long as you're alive.
So, first of all, I love that we began at the end. It's funny because just the other day I was reading a book, and it was digging into it's actually called the Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, and it's Carl Truman. It's a pretty interesting book. I don't know if you've read it. It's about the culture of expressive individualism in which we find ourselves, and the sexual revolution and all this stuff. But anyway, one of the words that it brought up that I started digging into is this study in philosophy and also in like hermeneutics and theology that's called eschatology, which is like the study of the ends of things. Kind of like teleology, but it's like played out, right?
Exactly.
And I feel like that's kind of where we're at here. We're having an eschatological discourse here, right, to kick off our podcast. But I love this concept of like, do you think that's the point? Actually, let me ask you this, because this is something I've been circulating on a lot lately, is like, what is the point of our existence?
Right, exactly. And this is the right question to be asking. And also, to step forward a bit, it's also the question to ask whenever you're doing a project. Someone just recently asked me some advice about a book, and the first question I always ask is, let's start at the end. Let's say, what do you want to get out of the book? What's the goal of the book? What's the purpose of whatever it is that you're doing, whether it's a book, a project, a business, even a startup? It's like, okay, what do you want out of it? If it was a raging success, what would that look like to you? Start at the end and then work your way into the beginning. So the question about what's the purpose, I think is a question that, not just for philosophers, it's a question you should be asking yourself all the time in terms of whether you're doing something. I have a bit of advice in the book saying, whenever you have the question of saying, what should I do next? You really want to say, what should I become? What am I becoming? What do I want to become? And so what is the purpose? I think, in the largest sense of the word, I think the purpose of our lives is to discover the purpose of our lives. That is not a paradox. That is the way of all sentient beings. And that's in a general sense. And I think in this particular, we have to have a particular answer. So the general answer is that we're all on a way of figuring out what it is that we're here for. So we don't get that. That's not a given. That's something we have to do, invent, discover. And then we have our particular answer, which is not the general answer. The particular answer is something that you've decided that you're going to aim towards. And for me, what I'm aiming for is basically trying to equip everybody born and yet born to manifest their particular and distinctive, unique genius. And so equipping it, it means lots of things, including, you know, having literacy and healthcare and universal access to drinking water and food and shelter, but also to equip them in terms of having the technologies and the tools that they need for their particularly weird combination of talents that they are going to enter into. And that's what I think technology is, and that's what I view it, and that's why I believe that we have a moral obligation to increase the technology in the world so that a person like you have the microphone, you've got your internets, and you've got If you're making films, you've got your cameras. And so my goal is spreading that opportunity and the new opportunities as wide as possible. And that's my particular mission. I think that other people, of course, will have a different answer in the particular, but the general answer is that your life is, the purpose of your life is to figure out the purpose of your life.
Man's Search for Meaning. I'm literally rereading that book right now.
Sure.
Yep. I would say I just completely and wholeheartedly agree with you. And it's funny because I'll share with you a little bit of context from my world. So I run this platform called Entrep, which is on the surface, it's an entrepreneurial education platform, rocking the sweatshirt. But what we really do, so people come into it like, hey, I want to start a business. I want to make more money. I want to quit my job. It's like, kind of call it a material objective, right? And what we really try to get people to do is basically what you're describing is to discover the purpose of their life, right? Their unique teleological rationale for existence, right? And then, the nice thing about entrepreneurship is you can merge the personal and the professional and presumably create a vocation or create a business or something that allows, that is either a manifestation of your unique creative purpose or an enablement to your unique creative purpose, because it gives you more lifestyle flexibility than per se, like maybe a job. So that's the impetus behind what we do. But the point is, I'm involved directly or indirectly in thousands of these, what is the point of me conversations? And so I have my perspective. I have a reasonably informed kind of data-based perspective on how people approach that question. And frankly, probably more importantly, how few people approach that question.
Right.
And so I wonder if you could, if we could keep it in the general, and then I want to get into the particular, right, particularly the particular of Kevin, but in the general, why do you think it isn't, I mean, it seems like it's natural for humans to ask these questions because in antiquity, we always did.
Sure.
It seems like in the modern world, we don't ask these questions as much. Although paradoxically, the technology that we're saturated with now, it can be used very much to unlock it if we will ask the question, but it seems like we're surfeited with it, so we don't ask the question. And so I'm curious your take on like, what's really going on in society that more people are not like ontologically focused when they have more tools with which to be than ever?
It's a good question. I think I might disagree with the idea that we are less inclined to do it now than before, because I had the privilege of traveling in a time machine. I got in a time machine in 1971, and I traveled back to the year 1500 for years, traveling in parts of Afghanistan in the north, the Himalayan villages, where they were literally living unchanged for hundreds of years, had not changed at all. Complete feudal societies, from not having electricity in the entire town, no plumbing, feudal, owner, serfs, child brides, the whole thing. I was living in a time machine. So I know that people back then were not any more inclined to wrestle with these big questions than today. I don't think it's necessarily a decrease in it because of modern technologies. I think it's just role models. Mm. It's hard to do. And for many people, it seems kind of pointless, particularly in the past. They were working their farm. It was not going to change. They were fated to do that. Those kinds of investigations were a luxury. And so if anything, I would tend to believe it's the other way around, that people now, because our basic needs are so satisfied and so easily satisfied, that's the Maslow's hierarchy. Like we don't find it difficult in the same way that people did hundreds of years ago to have enough to eat, that we're now actually have the luxury of being able to do the self-actualization stuff that becomes more important to us now. And so that's one of the things I've observed about my travels around the world, is that there is a convergence around the world. The 8 billion people, there's a convergence on how we are kind of addressing the basic Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you know, food, shelter, clothing. And the answer is that we all have sneakers, t-shirts, a concrete air-conditioned box with Wi-Fi. That is their basic needs. And that's what everybody is going to. And it's becoming more and more available. And therefore, those higher level needs are now, we can now address them. We can now actually wrestle with this question. Well, why am I here? What's the point of it? And even more so these days with AI and genetic engineering is like, well, what's my role, both as a human and as an individual? And I think, so I agree with you that it's important and it's not easily done very often, but I might disagree with you on the trend. And I would say, like you, I agree that we have more tools than ever, but we also have more doubts and uncertainties than ever. I think people long ago were very clear about the centrality of humans, and they were wrong about the centrality. We weren't the center, but they were certain about that belief. And they didn't question necessarily the what it meant to be a human. That was assumed to be fixed, eternal, sacred. But now, in addition to questioning about our own lives, we are now at the position of saying, well, what do humans do? We're making this world up. What's the role of us? Are we changeable? Are we mutable? Is human nature something that we can mess with? So we have the double uncertainty about that. And when we're asking these questions about what's our point, it's a very big cloud of uncertainty right now.
Well, I guess, first of all, I appreciate the clarification around, you know, antiquity versus the present.
Right.
And you know, having not myself done any time travel, I'm inclined to believe you on that. But also, I think probably more than like the raw quantity of such considerations, I'm more commenting on how it seemed like historically we had all the reasons in the world not to ask profound questions, because day to day we were locked in a constant struggle for survival. And yet still, there's so much ancient mystical writing and musing and such. Okay. Whereas, so it's almost like we did it in spite of our circumstances in the past. Whereas now, to your point, like the first three, and in many cases, four levels of Maslow's hierarchy are tended to for most people.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just the world that I inhabit as, you know, being out there in social media as an influencer or content creator. I do not get a particularly robust sense from the world at large that we're focused on these profound investigations of the deepest questions.
Right.
It seems like the majority, not the absolute, but just the majority is using the luxury of comfort and security as a basis for a lot of like materialism and instant gratification and dopamine aversion, and not asking these questions when it's like, oh my gosh, how can we not be taking better advantage of this reality right now?
Yeah, again, I might disagree a little bit. I think there's a survivor bias in the ancient wisdom. You see the stuff that has been saved and the people talking about that and the other stuff
right
away.
That's fair.
But nonetheless, I think your larger point is absolutely correct, which is that there's an insufficient awareness for this big question or the appreciation of the necessity for it. And we seem to have all the tools around us to do it even better. And it's difficult for many people, and or many people aren't doing it. And I would agree. And I think, because I'm an optimist, I think actually this stuff about AI is going to propel more people to have to ask that question.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases, because we will need to have particular answers. We can't just wave our hands and say, oh, well, it's philosophy, it doesn't really matter. I'll work through it. But no, we actually have to have an answer. We actually have to code something in. And so so I think you talk about ethological, I think that we're headed into a whole century of epistemological dissent and conversation where we're going to be wrestling with this at the society level. That becomes a topic of conversation at most dinner parties, where they're talking about what's the point of being human? What are we trying to do? What are we trying to optimize? How do we become better at being a human? This is going to become a major topic, I think, because we're going to have to answer it. And not just one person, but a lot of people have to have some kind of consensus on making policies, regulations, whatever. So that may be good for the problem that you've noticed, which is that to our conversation, that you kind of want to start there in order to answer the question of what should I do next and what business should I be in? Is this a good business? And so, even answering, there's the general and then there's specific about this person. What do they want out of it? And maybe someday that'll be taught in business school. Maybe someday that would be kind of
I just want to say, I actually think it's abstract and absurd that it's not currently taught in business school.
Right, exactly. I agree.
That you're going to go into, we're just going to qualify you to go into the business of busyness rather than the business of self-expression through work. I mean, what was it? Work is love made manifest. That's Khalil Gibran.
Right.
And yet most of us are being taught to work as a separate compartment from our reality or our significant life. So anyway, whatever, we're getting in pretty deep waters here. So, which I love, by the way, thank you for going there with me. Let's bring it back to you. So what is, you've talked about your purpose. I think I love the way you framed it. It was about equipping people to bring their unique genius to life or something to that effect. Yeah. So what is next then? I'm starting where you told me to start 20 minutes later.
We're in the middle.
What is,
Starts the next middle.
Yeah, for you then.
Next to me is, I'm working on a project called the Protopia, the 100-year desirable future. So I'm making a set of scenarios, fiction, we'll call it, scenarios, of a world full of ubiquitous AI and powerful genetic engineering and ubiquitous surveillance and everything else. And that's a world that I want to live in. Okay? It's very easy, and Hollywood does all the time, describe mixtures of that are just hellish and they're dystopian, right? That we don't want to live in. That's easy and cheap. Problems are always cheap to see. And because that's entropy, that's the general trend of the universe, as things break, that's inevitable, that's the probable. But the improbable, where things work, are much harder to imagine. And so I'm trying to imagine this version of the world that I want to live in, and at 10-year increments of how it arrives there. It's not a prediction. It's what we call in the scenario business a normative scenario, meaning that it's something that is desired. It's a desirable future. But what I know about history is that we're not going to make really complicated good futures inadvertently, accidentally. They're hard enough to do on purpose. They can't do them accidentally. So in order to do them on purpose, you have to have a vision of what it is that we're aiming to do, and the belief that it can be accomplished. And so that imagining it is part of what we're not doing very much right now. We're mostly focused on the problems, again, which are easy to see. And I don't deny the problems, and they are severe. But I think we need more optimism to counter that and to enable us to make a future that actually we want to live in.
Yeah, I just want to say for the record, and I'm willing to be quoted on this and return to it years from now, and I'm aligned with you. I actually think that, the long arc of history is actually bending away from entropy. I mean, that's a fact. And that there's no reason, as dystopian as scientific fiction wants, to insist the future is going to look, like, we're already living somebody else's sci-fi future with medicine and genetic engineering and you know, climate control and automobile, you know, transportation, you name it, magnetic bullet trains. And so far, Thomas Malthus 60 years ago was telling us that it would be impossible to support 8 billion people on this planet. Right. And we have used technology to make it not only possible, but where the average person today has a lot better conditions than they did when he said that. And I don't see any reason to believe that's not going to happen again.
The average person today is living better than the kings of what he said.
Exactly. And so I don't see any reason for pessimism about the future. Humans are remarkably resilient, and there seems to be this, you know, invisible hand, if you will, that's actually guiding us to, thus far, we've had plenty of tech that we could have used to destroy ourselves.
Yeah.
And we haven't. So anyway, for the record, I agree with you. I wonder, could you talk, are there any of those scenarios that you think could be useful that beyond just being interesting for you and I to talk through, that right. could potentially assist the audience in visualizing perhaps a more positive future than what they're normally presented with?
Well, I mean, one possibility is that we are able to actually manage climate change. We can't really solve it in a sense, but we can manage climate change so that it's not as horrific. And so we do the things we know we need to do, you know, more green energy, more nuclear power, all those kinds of things come online, maybe even fusion at some point in the near future. And so we begin to steady the climate rise and manage the whatever consequences we have done so far. So that's one scenario. In other words, like, it's fixable. We can fix it. It is a problem, but we can manage it. We know how to do that. Therefore, that's part of the picture, is that over the next century, we learn to deal with that. So there's plenty of business opportunities in doing that. There'll be a lot of money being made doing that, but it is part of the picture that I would say going forward.
So what do you say to people who are sort of insistently pessimistic about the future, particularly right now with AI? You know, it's going to wipe out whole industries. It's going to eliminate whole categories of jobs, and people want to demonize it for that. What do you say to what do you say to the general conversation? And then what would you say to the individual?
Yeah.
Probably is going to be negatively affected. You know, let's say a guy that drives a truck, we're not going to need people to drive trucks in 10 years, right? Like, so the macro and the micro, how do you answer the question?
So I think let's just start with the micro as an example. So self-driving cars, self-driving trucks, they will come over time. They're going to be a lot harder to do than we think, because just as we didn't simply just replace horse carriages with automobiles, we actually made an entire infrastructure to accommodate cars, interstate highways, on-ramps, gas stations. We're not going to be able to just swap out human-driven cars with auto-driven cars without changing the infrastructure. So we'll have whole infrastructure build-outs that we need to do, special lanes, special changing traffic lights, all kinds of things over the coming decades to accommodate that. And in the meantime, I think I can easily imagine truck drivers where for 95% of that route, they're not needed. And they could be living in a cab, working on a computer, doing some other job. And they're needed for the last 5%, where they're going to drive through the streets of Boston and back up and park into the thing. Where initially, that's not something that the AI is going to do very well. And so, yes, over time, we won't need the number of truck drivers we have. But I don't. But for most, there'll probably be a natural attrition where very few of the people are going to be fired, just like AI artists. I've not heard of a single artist who lost their job to AI. It's very, very unlikely. You won't lose your job, but you might lose your job description.
Or you might lose your job to somebody who's doing your job with the help of AI, because
it limits it to your job description. You're going to do a different set of tasks.
Well, I guess the point I was making was to challenge people that are being fatalistic about AI to say, there's somebody out there who does your same job, who's learning how to do it assisted with AI, that's going to be more desirable than you if you resist it.
Yeah, that's true. But I think even those people aren't going to be fired. There was, again, the evidence so far shows that we imagined all the radiologists would be out of the job, but actually they're increasing the number of radiologists that they're hiring. They're just doing different tasks. The kind of understanding of it is being assisted by AI, but not necessarily replacing them. So what I'm saying is there will be a transformation of jobs, but there isn't mm-hmm. going to be mass layoffs. Okay, so that's, of all the problems to worry about AI, employment is the least worrisome.
Okay. Okay. Good, and I think the world needs to hear that right now.
Right, right,
a lot
right,
of people
right.
are freaked out about it.
So. Right, so just look at the evidence. So most of the worries about AI is, if you ask, they did pollings of people, is your job, we'll ask you, is your job, are you afraid of your job being replaced by an AI? And what people say is, not my job, but I can imagine my friend's friend's job being. So it's all third person worry. Okay? They're imagining. So again, we can imagine how things break much easier than we can imagine how they work. You were mentioning, because that's entropy, and that there is this arc against entropy, and there's a term for it, which is exotropy. There's entropy down, and there's exotropy, this unloading. So this exotropy is what life is about. It's this continuous cascade of increasing order of a certain type in a world. And the way we have exotropy and life and intelligence is that actually we increase the speed of making entropy. It actually, exotropy requires us to increase entropy around it. Okay, so that's the price. So your laptop is very exotropic, but it's incredibly entropic because it's making all the heat. It's like burning. You can feel the heat. All that heat is coming from all that intelligence that is doing inside. So yes,
can I paraphrase? Entropy is the wake of exotropy.
Yes,
sense.
Exactly.
That's so interesting.
But entropy happens outside of it. You don't need exotropy to make entropy. It'll happen anywhere. But the price of exotropy is actually increasing entropy locally. And so, so that's the demise, the way things break. To imagine the problems is the easiest entropic way, whereas to imagine and have a vision where people work better and work in partnerships, that's harder to see, more expensive, so to speak. Calculation and energy, but much more likely, given our history, given right. the fact that progress is real. So I always start with these arguments to people who are saying it's going to be terrible. Is like, do you accept and recognize and acknowledge the reality of progress? Because we don't need to have, what's the word I want? We don't need to have a majority of good things to happen to have progress. We need to have just 1% more than we just need to create 1% more than we destroy every year. 1% more. So we could destroy and harm 49% crap. If 51% is good, that difference of 2% is almost invisible. Who can see 2% difference? But that 2% is what we compound over time. So that 2% compounded every year, 2% delta, 2% difference between the good and bad is just a little bit. That's compounded. And that's what civilization is. It's the compounding.
Hey there. Sorry to interrupt the show, but I just have a quick favor to ask. So we recently broke into the top 100 podcasts in the entrepreneurship category. We've been hovering around 75, and we're really trying to push up into like the top 20 and grow the impact of the show. So if you enjoy what we do here and you're a supporter, the biggest thing you could do to help would be to leave us a positive review. Whatever platform you're listening on, you should be able to leave a quick review, let the world know what you like about the show. Thank you so much for your time, and let's get back to it.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking as you're describing it, is that like progress is exponential.
No.
Whereas like, well, I mean that it compounds. It's logarithmic, right?
It's compounding.
Yeah. Whereas failure is linear. It just, right. you fail and then you don't build on top of the right. failure to an even greater failure. So I would argue that you could probably 1% successes yeah. compounding over time would offset 99% of failures that just simply right. fail and stop.
Right. Exactly. And so that's, so that is the power of compounding failure. And that's why the larger or longer view you take, the more optimistic you can become. If you want to yeah. be optimistic, take a longer view. Think about 10 years or 20 years, because that compounding over 20 years can overcome horrendous downturns, recessions, wars, are all overwhelmed by 2% compounding over a century.
Yeah, the I love that you've defined, I'm trying to remember exactly, you founded an organization that champions long-term thinking.
Right.
You know, a lot, most of the really good, I'm moving kind of the entrepreneurial influencer type of circles. And that is, I would say, the dividing line between the real leaders in that world and what I'll call the pretenders. The pretenders are trying to fashion entrepreneurship as an implement of short-term gain. The leaders are talking about entrepreneurship in the context of the long game, both socially and individually, for the, you know, the meaning of your life, so to speak. So I love that focus. And frankly, to, you know, there's an audience that's going to hear this. I want to really impart that. Like you said, you never arrive at being fully yourself. I also don't think you ever fully arrive at long-term thinking.
Sure. Absolutely. 100%.
It's incremental, and you can always think longer term. And I would encourage anybody listening, whatever time horizon you tend to view the world through, try to stretch it out.
Right. Well, that was the genius of Jeff Bezos, who famously was very persuasive with his board and stockholders to convince them to allow him to think long-term, to say, well, no, we're not going to take all the profits right now. We're going to keep investing into this, and that we'll have this machine, this flywheel that he famously talks about,
right.
get it going. And that if you are with me and are patient and take the long-term view, then we can begin to reap even bigger benefits. And that was kind of like the marshmallow test. You've heard the marshmallow test of the kids in kindergarten being given one marshmallow, sitting in front of it and say, you can have it now, or if you're patient and wait, delayed gratification, you can have three marshmallows later on. And then they leave, and the kid yeah. sitting in front of the marshmallow trying to think long term. And so Jeff also says, you know, he built a business on not what changed, but on the things that didn't change over that time. So I think it's not just a societal thing. I think even for individuals and for companies, taking a longer term and saying, this is a 10-year or 20-year project before we're really going to see that, but we're going to build this in a foundational way and a proper way, a generous way, an abundant way to know that we can actually maximize the good for everybody by taking a longer view.
So I'm glad you brought up the marshmallow test. I think this test illustrates a really important aspect of true long-term thinking, not sort of qualified or rigged long-term thinking, which is that long-term thinking has to correlate with the ability, real long-term thinking, the kind that does compound like we're talking about, has to correlate with the ability to tolerate uncertainty or to tolerate the unknown. Because one of the variables or one of the really important elements of that experiment was that they didn't tell the kids when the second marshmallow was coming.
Right, right.
It's not like they said, hey, just wait 10 minutes and you can have two marshmallows. They were like, hey, something came up. I got to leave. And I'll be back when I can, right?
Yeah.
And when I come back, I'll bring you a second marshmallow. But it could have been, for all they knew, it could have been a week.
Yeah.
But and so that was the unique ability of those kids that quote passed the test, and you know, was that they could delay gratification and tolerate the uncertainty of that gratification. And I think that's really important, especially if you're building a business. Like business, we work in sprint cycles. We work in quantifiables. We work in knowns. We have investors we have to show pictures to of this is where we're headed. And like that changing the conversation around, hey, the uncertain, the unknown has to not only become acceptable or tolerable, it has to be embraced, or else you can't actually cross the chasm to real long-term thinking. That is, I mean, that goes against everything that is hardwired into our, you know, reptilian limbic brains, right? Like we want to know, we want to know now, we want to be safe for knowing.
And I think that maybe the only thing that might help offset some of that uncertainty is a sense of history. And if you have a sense of history, you have some confidence that the general trend, historical trends, is for, you know, the cost, the more things that are produced, you know, the kind of the learning curves, the more things are produced, the cheaper they become. That's you know, the laws of economics, the idea that there's always substitutions for any kind of scarce resource, that in general, through technology, we have been increasing our span of life and our safety, and that those things, all those ingredients are still at work. So there is some, it's not as if it's uncertain and we really literally have no idea of where this is going. I think part of you know, starting a business, starting something, is that we have some idea of a likely bounded perimeter of where things are likely to happen, even though we don't know and we'll be surprised and it's not reasonable. It's not like there's complete 100%, this could go anyway. Mm-hmm. There are long, my friend Stuart Brand has his pace layering, he calls it pace layering. So there's all these different paces. So at the top is fashion and clothing, which is just like, it's like chaos. It's so fast. It's completely 100% unpredictable. And then you have kind of like infrastructural things. And at the very bottom, you have this glacial moving kind of level of culture and language, which just moves very, very slowly. And because it's moving slowly, it's a little bit more, less uncertain in the sense that it's probably going to continue. And so there is a whole layers of this moving at different levels with the slowest at the bottom. And so we have some benefit of that. I would say, to this point, I would say in 100 years, I'd be willing to bet that most of the roads, say in America or the world, are in exactly the same place as they are now. Because it's so expensive to change the course of a road. And there's so little advantage to doing so that the layout of the roads and cities and towns is probably going to be exactly the same in 100 years. Now, I could be wrong, but that's a very high probability because that's the slow set.
Right. So
you can kind of like count on that when you're doing your calculations. That is something you have a higher reliability, a higher certainty of. And so we can break down that uncertainty to kind of like different levels. And so there is some confidence for an entrepreneur who is having to make a bet is that understanding that there are things that are continuing have huge momentum, like demographics. Unfortunately, the demographics are not in our favor. The demographics are going to be very worrisome because we're losing population across the entire planet. We don't have any kind of experience in running growth economies with fewer and fewer people. So we don't know how.
Yeah, and if somebody doesn't know what you're referring to, it's the correlation between the economic development and the decline in birth rate. That right. Economic development reaches a point where birth rate goes below replacement rate, actually.
Right, it already is in most countries.
Yeah.
So we're already below replacement level, but what we're now first experiencing is the absolute reduction in the total number of people. Because again, those demographics are this long course. Mm-hmm. You can have below replacement for decades before you actually see a decrease in population.
Right.
So we've seen that below fertility level replacement decades ago. And it's going to be another decades before we actually experience that decline. But that's what I meant by there are certain things where they're uncertain. So the uncertainty is not an entire uniform cloud.
So, speaking of certainty and uncertainty, I'll share, you know, another perspective, and then I'd like to hear you sort of how you apply this in your life. Is that I think you can in the desire for certainty, you can substitute outcomes, which a focus on outcome certainty is gonna naturally shorten your time horizon.
Yeah.
But you can substitute that for principles.
Right.
Where you can be deeply certain of the principles right. upon which you're operating. And if you've identified the real first principles
yeah. that
are relevant to whatever you're doing, those are going to hold as long as you want them to over whatever length of game you want to play. And Simon Sinek would tell us to play the infinite game, right? But anyway, I think that's really important. When you talk about referencing history, it's not so that you can try to forecast outcomes. It's so that you can mine for the right principles.
Right, exactly. And I recommend a book called From Good to Great. Jim Collins,
yeah.
Which is the difference between the companies that are just good companies versus great ones. And the ones that are great, basically, they retain and articulate their values and they change everything else. It's like what business we're in doesn't matter. What matters is that we have these values, these core principles, these core values, and they don't ever change. And everything else around it is completely mutable, flexible, and up to you know revision, and so including what industry you're in, mm-hmm. and so that and he identified that those great companies had those core unchangeable values rather than the outcomes.
Yeah, and a lot of the great iconic American companies, particularly mid 20th century, they weren't even in an industry; they were conglomerates.
Right.
They were taking values and operationalizing them across industries and buying and selling out in and out of whole industries. So, okay. So on this principles question, I'm curious if you, I know that you do, but you know, could you articulate or specify kind of what are some of the first principles that you try to operate from both micro and macro?
So I've changed my mind over the years as I got older, and I became much more convinced that our story we tell ourselves as children, or we tell children, that the world and human nature is basically selfish. That is the kind of reflex is untrue. Mm. That in fact, while the animal nature of us is that way, the whole agenda of humanity and our own civilization and our own civilizing effect is that we can overcome. Those basic principles to make kindness a default, to trusting strangers as a default, that the basic grain of the universe is full of abundance, kindness, gratitude, and that is the default. And if you align yourself with that, you're actually aligning yourself with the universe for good, and that you will thrive as you do that. So my basic set of principles is that. To trust strangers, to trust the best in people, and that occasionally you might be cheated. And if you are, you willingly pay that as a tax for the great benefits mm-hmm. that you get from treating people at their best because they're going to give you their best.
I had a guy on the show, the episode's not out yet, but by the time anyone hears this, this other one will be. And his name was Leon Logothetis. Have you ever heard of him?
No.
So he has a show, I think it's on Discovery Plus, called The Kindness Diaries.
Mm.
And he basically travels. He left his career as a successful shipping broker in the United Kingdom. And he started basically hitchhiking around and essentially living off of the kindness of strangers. Mm. And he's now traveled to over 100 countries, subsisting entirely.
Yeah,
off of the kindness of people he's yeah. never met before, and then he started documenting it, and it totally supports what you're saying.
Right, it's totally reliable, and somebody who's hitchhiked a lot, I know that, and what I've learned to do is become a good recipient of gifting, but the idea that again, there's a paradox at the fundamental nature of human existence, which is that the most selfish thing you can do is to be generous. That the more you give, the more you get. That does not add up. The arithmetic does not add up. If everybody in the world was giving and getting more back, it's like no mathematics supports that. That does not compute. But that is the paradox at the foundation of the universe. And I think if you align yourself with those principles, it's the most selfish thing you can do.
So I'm curious, to what extent do you feel like spirituality, or perhaps more overtly religion or faith practice, how does it kind of fit into this larger optimistic futurism and the eschatology or teleology of man and your own personal walk? Like, how have you sort of reconciled, Nietzsche would tell us that we invented all that just because we didn't have answers to questions now have answers to, but I don't know if you agree. So,
yeah, no, I have a faith. I have a faith in God, and I find it perfectly integrates with my writings, understandings of evolution, and here's the way I would begin this story very, very briefly, which is, look, okay, you can have your story of the universe is where did it come from? Talking about what's the point? Where did it come from? So you can see either that the universe always was, okay? So there's just no question. It just always was. I don't know how this always was. Or you can say the universe made itself. The Big Bang created itself. Or you could say that there was a God and the God creates the universe. But then you have the question, well, where did God come from? And you can say, well, he created itself. All those stories are completely unsatisfactory, right? None of them are satisfactory. They just don't work. But I like the version of God because that's a better story. Okay, so that's the story I'm going with. All right, so you have this God, and the thing about God is God's not done. He's a being that made the universe in order to help it understand himself. It's a self-created being, and that self-creation was so vast and immaterial that it needed the universe to help it understand itself, the God. And so we're actually, God needs us to help it understand what God is about. And that's sort of what we're doing. And I think of, going back to why we're here, the way I would put it, is we're here to surprise God. God could have thought of all the things that we could think of, but he decided to kind of like make it more fun and help him understand himself by letting us have that free will and that ability to create things in our own minds that maybe he could have, but by letting us do it, he comes to understand himself.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point that implicit in the concept of free will, I think this will logically hold, must be embedded the possibility of the creation or the thought or the something that was not already anticipated by that which created free will. Otherwise, it wasn't really free will.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's...
Of course, the danger of free will, if you give something free will, and we're discovering this with AI right now, if you give something free will, it has this, it will choose things that aren't good. And the question is, why would you allow that if you could do something evil? That's because that's the cost, that's the trade-off to have free will, and which is part of what I see our creation is reflecting. So yeah, you make these beings that have the potential to surprise you, but they also have the potential to do harm and hurt each other. And so the question is, as a maker of these, how do you deal with that? How do you deal with both the justice and the necessary lenience that you need if the things you're creating, like AIs and robots, can do harm? So the thing is that we're now in this business of becoming gods and making AIs, and we're going to have to confront this thing. And so to your question about religion, I think we might see the arrival of new religious ideas based on this idea that we are as gods, and maybe even appreciation of what some of those ancient religions were wrestling with of old, which is, how do we explain suffering in the world? Because we're going to give these robots pain. Pain is very useful. It's not the same as suffering, but we're going to give them pain because that's a useful signal. So we're going to have these questions ourselves of like, how do we deal with this? And I think that may turn people to re-examine traditional religions to see what was there in terms of answers.
I wonder if, to hearken to the messianic narrative, I wonder if a man is going to have to become AI to save AI from itself. If we had a lot more time, we could like take that and run with it. Oh my goodness. You have a book. We started with what comes next.
Yeah.
But what is now is a wonderful book that you've published. Excellent Advice for Living. I think we should probably close out by giving you some space to talk about that because people can go get that now.
Right. We're going to end with the beginning.
Yes.
First. So this is a book, Excellent Advice for Living. There's 400 little tiny tweets, little proverbs that I've written down over the years that originally were for the help of my three children who are now young adults. And it literally is mostly wisdom and advice I wish I had gotten earlier, wish I'd known earlier. And they range from the stuff we're talking about, you know, being kind rather than be right. If you have an opportunity, a choice between being correct or being kind, be kind. To practical things like a bit of advice, if you're invited to do something in 6 months from now, ask yourself whether you would do it if it was tomorrow morning, because oftentimes you won't. Mm. And it'll be tomorrow morning pretty soon, and then it's too late. So I use that all the time when I get invited to do something.
Wow.
That's when I say, would I do this? I get on a plane and go there if it was tomorrow morning. And oftentimes, their usually answer is no. So I have to say no politely. Learn how to say no politely and firmly. You don't need to give any reasons when you're saying no. So that's kind of advice in the book. And there's 450 of them. I think it's really great for young people. And I've heard from parents that, well, my kids don't listen to what I'm saying. So I hand them your book and they'll listen to that.
Mm. Wonderful. Excellent Advice for Living. It certainly sounds like that. And I'm totally stealing that bit about if you wouldn't say yes tomorrow, don't say yes for 6 months, 6 months out. Okay. How about where else would you send people to discover more of Kevin Kelly and go deeper into your world?
Yeah. So I have a website that has my initials, KK, Kevin Kelly, KK at KK.org, KK.org. And I have including pictures from my Vanishing Asia opus, which has 9,000 pictures that I took over 50 years in Asia, very remote places in the time machine. My scientific technical writing. I have a recommendation newsletter called Recommendo every week, free.
That I read has one of the highest open rates of any email newsletter in the world. Wow.
Yeah, it does.
As a digital marketer, I very much appreciate, respect that. Yeah.
And then on the socials where I post my daily art for several years is Kevin2Kelly, Kevin Kelly with the two in the middle. I try to art every day.
That sounds amazing. Okay, well, I guess the audience will be the judge. Did the most interesting man in the world to the most interesting people in the world live up to the hype? I'm going to vote yes. Kevin, this has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for joining us here on the show.
It's really been a super pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Thank you for your great questions.
Oh, thank you. And to all you viewers and listeners out there, you are the best part of the show. Even when Kevin Kelly's on the show, you're still the best part of the show. You're why I do what I do every day. I'm so glad we got to spend this time together. Can't wait to see you again next time. Take care.
Hey, it's Jeff here. If you liked this episode of Unlock Your Potential, it would mean so much if you would like and share the episode on whatever platform you're listening or viewing on. And if you really like what we're doing here and you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving a review. There is so much work that goes into these episodes, and you leaving a positive review lets us know that that work is reaching people, and especially it helps us reach other people. Your review could be the reason that someone else decides to tune in, check out this podcast, and unlock their potential and ultimately level up the quality of their life. So thank you so much for your support and for listening, especially if you like or share or leave a review. Thank you for helping us spread the word, and thank you for unlocking your potential to go make the world and your world a better place.